Coming up, the sublime, the ridiculous, and the you've got to be kidding me from Frankfurt Motor Show, and all the other topics worth talking about. Next on Autoline After Hours.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by the 2013 Hyundai Elantra. Learn more at Hyundai.com.
This is Autoline After Hours with Peter DiLorenzo, episode 210 for Friday, September 13th, 2013, Frankfurt, from the sublime to the ridiculous.
Watch Autoline After Hours live at Autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Hey, everybody. It's another scintillating episode of Autoline After Hours. Glad you could join us. And joining me tonight is Mr. Gary Vasilash from Automotive Design and Production. Gary, how are you?
I'm doing good, Peter.
Mr. You? Todd Lasse, who literally is just off the plane from Frankfurt. So we have plenty to talk about, right, Todd?
You got it, Peter.
Okay. So, you know, it was an uneventful show, nothing really going on. I mean, there was so much going on in Frankfurt, it was almost like it should be like a three-month show. You just kind of keep going, waves of people going, coming back, showing more stuff. So let's get into it a little bit. There's plenty to talk about, though. So how about overall, the Germans have decided now that electrification is the ticket. Is that the...
Well, I think they have, and I think they're looking at it as kind of a luxury item, BMW being the perfect example. And of course, the Germans sell a lot of cars in the U.S. and California specifically. And in California, they have the mandate, so it makes it easier. Yeah. It's interesting, all the shuttles that take journalists from building to building, but I walk just to try to... take care of all the German food I eat while I'm there, were electrified cars. There was a plug-in hybrid Mercedes S-Class. There were BMW i3s. Everything except the classic Minis, which Mini had outfitted for the drives back and forth. They had some Opel Amperas taking us back and forth. Just to describe it for viewers who might not know, it's a very spread out, huge. I mean, it'll wear you down very quickly. 10 halls basically, and you walk between.
So 10 Kobo halls, but only bigger Kobo halls.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. And plus the purpose built building that BMW used to own, and now Audi has taken that over, and they did their upside-down city in it. The upside-down city are buildings up on the ceiling, made to look like a city kind of at night, and then mirrors for the roads in between them, so you have the Audis on the floor, and they're reflected up into the mirror.
It's all about urban mobility, so they needed to build that city.
Yeah, it was... It may have masked the fact that they showed yet another Audi Quattro concept car rather than a production Audi Quattro, and
that was the orange metallic thing.
Yeah, it was yellowish, really, and I don't think too many people were impressed, myself included. It was too a little bit too sharp edged and boxy, and like the roof line, the C pillar was kind of, well, are we doing a hatchback or are we doing a coupe? And then they used the A7 as a basis for it, which is a big car. I just thought that was too big for something like that.
I thought it was interesting, and I mentioned this on the website, that swinging dickism is alive and well in the car business, because Nissan, every pronouncement was, you know, we were here 4 years ago. We just about invented the electric car. We showed the world back then. We continue to show the world. And then the Volkswagen Group answered with, we will dominate the electrification of the automobile by 2018. And I was just like, you know, nothing ever changes with these guys. It's always something.
Our design editor, Robert Cumberford, who was also at the show, one of his misses, we at automobilemag.com, we published hits and misses from the show. You can go and see and comment on it, positive or negative. He criticized Volkswagen for doing an electric Golf that was all steel, just a conventional Golf that didn't have any lightweight materials or anything. So he saw that as a bit of a minus.
See, but that's interesting. I mean, what I thought the announcement of Volkswagen, you know, holding forth about, you know, we will have the electrification of the vehicle and on and on and on. And it's like, did they sort of forget that Toyota's been doing this for a little while? And I think that, and if you think, you know, because I started counting, I mean, because it's for all of the brands. This isn't Volkswagen. It's Volkswagen Group will be dominant. So, you know, you'd have Porsche, Audi, Volkswagen, Skoda, Seat, Lamborghini, mm-hmm. you know.
Well, don't forget.
Ducati. I mean, it's just.
Ducati, right.
Well, I mean, and BMW showed an electric motorcycle.
Yeah.
Scooter, right?
I thought it was a bike.
Close enough. Yes, it was a motorcycle.
But I'm just saying that.
Yeah,
I mean,
because I did see it earlier. Now that
so you have this thing of like, oh, we're gonna have all of these things. It's as though they invented.
Well, it's consistent with the Germans though, because if they didn't do it, it doesn't exist. When they do it, it exists now. You know, they've always been that way.
It's very interesting to me if we go back not that many years, that they were nothing but highly contemptuous of hybrid powertrains, saying that it would just be diesels, that, you know, this is foolish to have two separate systems and the diesel is far superior. And
yeah, you're right. I wonder when the light switch literally went off for them, because, you know.
I think they're slowly coming to the conclusion that diesels are never going to be that big in the United States as long as we don't have higher gas taxes. And that, again, remember how big the United States is to their market. It's the second largest market for most of those cars. It may still be number one for a few different models here and there, although China is also a factor there. But, you know, and China may also be a factor in terms of the electrification. So they've just decided they have to do it.
So let's go over some of the manufacturers. The Mercedes showed the S Coupe concept, yep. which is basically the replacement for the CL, which they're not going to call the CL anymore. How did that look in person? It certainly looked nice in the photos.
It looked very nice in person. It's the front end has this kind of bold design. I love what they do with grille. I think Mercedes has turned the corner quite sharply just in the last couple of redesigns.
Yeah.
And the side surfacing, it looked long. I mean, it just had this lengthy look with no solid B pillar, just a great what Americans would call a two door hardtop coupe with a lovely flowing B pillar, C pillar, I guess. The one thing I thought about it when I saw the photos, and then I thought about it when I saw the car in person, that BMW is going to have a lawsuit over those tail lamps. You know, I mean, it looks straight off of a 6 Series or...
off the Grand Coupe.
Off the Grand Coupe, right.
Yeah.
And in fact, the whole rear end treatment's got a little bit of that going on. But otherwise, I mean, just a really dynamic, you know...
I'm a little surprised at the roof line. As it transitions down to the deck lid, mm-hmm. it looks a little awkward to me.
Really?
How did it look in person?
I didn't think it looked awkward at all, but...
I think it looks better to me than the sedan.
See, I mean, so you notice how you have the sunroof before you get to the backlight.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got that area back there, and it just seems very, like, they kept going, and they should have gone down faster.
Mm.
But I'm sure that it was about rear seat headroom.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't lose that, because I'm sure that would be one of the factors of saying, okay, we can accommodate tall people.
And maybe that people who buy those cars don't necessarily look at them as something that they're going to drive cross-country or across the continent with a lot of luggage, that obviously for a longer trip it's going to be a two-person car.
Right.
And you've got enough luggage space even, and that's where you probably lost a little bit with that roof line.
Mm-hmm.
The sunroof thing, I don't know, it's like everybody has to have a bigger sunroof these days.
You know,
are they trying to replace convertibles?
You know, that's a trend I really don't care for. I don't like the glass roofs. I just don't. I know they do two things for me. They add weight and mm-hmm. complication.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm going to add weight to a car, it's not going to be up in the roof.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I have my druthers. But was this Mercedes one of your hits from the show?
It was one of my hits from the show. I was also surprised at how much I liked the GLA class, seeing that in the tin for the first time.
You know, from the photos, I happen to think the GLA looks pretty good. I mean, maybe better than the CLA for some reason, but clearly the European market has embraced the whole crossover thing with an SUV thing with vigor.
This is even almost more blatantly in the way the BMW X1 is compared to an X3, more blatantly kind of a tall hatchback more than a crossover. I didn't have time to get in the back seat and see exactly how much space there is back there. There's not a hell of a lot, and I think it's going to be for people who want a small exterior package but with some versatility inside. I think it's going to be a hit.
It looks small.
Yeah. Well, I think it's probably about the same size as the X1. Of course, it's a front-wheel drive platform instead of a rear-wheel drive platform. But
yeah, you'd be hard-pressed to find that out in any of the write-ups from Mercedes. We sort of conveniently forgot to mention that it's front-wheel drive. So.
Well, and of course, BMW is going to be going there with their 1 Series.
When is BMW going to do that, by the way? Is that soon? There's got to be some sort of global media thing for that.
I think they're within about a year of that. But the question is whether they'll sell the 1 Series in the U.S. Remember, the 1 Series coupe becomes the 2 Series with their new nomenclature. And everything I've heard is that the 2 Series will remain a rear-wheel drive car. Hmm. So... So
let's talk about BMW. I mean, I gotta say that the i8 looks pretty impressive.
I like the i8 a lot. I think they did a great job on that car, and they did a good job of making it. It looks pretty much like the concept. So it wasn't. It was one of Robert Comerford's hits from the show. It wasn't real big news to me just because we've been seeing it a lot. I went on a preview late last year that was completely off the record, embargoed, so I couldn't talk about it at the time. But to me, it wasn't like a brand new car at the show, but it certainly got a lot of attention, and it looks as good as the concept looked. And you know, it's a very dynamic kind of car. Again, the idea is if you can take electrification, whether it's an extended range like the i8 or a full electric, and make it.
I mean, the difference in the i8 from the show car we saw, or have been seeing for forever, is they showed cars with color on them,
mm-hmm.
whereas the concept always was a certain way. And when you see the cars with color on them, it changes the whole car.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of color and speaking of the i8, so yesterday while driving through Santa Monica, my co-driver and I spotted a car with camo on it.
Uh-huh.
And we were like, gee, what is this? Now, the camo was a rather unusual camo. It looked like blue and white paisley. Okay? And so, you know, we hurry up and we get behind the car and we're trying to figure it out. And this thing just looked so very exotic and bizarre. And we finally came to the conclusion we were watching the i8. Driving through the streets of Santa Monica.
And by the way, if you could go to the picture again, you know, the C-pillar in that car has it has a panel that separates from the body, so you have air going through that. Our David Zenley has had a short drive in that car, and maybe the very same one, because the photos they've released have been of the Paisley car, of the mule. So, yeah, the air.
That's right there, toward the back.
I mean, at first we thought that that was maybe added on to be, you know, to throw you off of what it was, because we're saying, you know, is that the NSX or is this a new Lexus that's being developed, and those things don't look like they're exactly attached correctly, but could have just been the wallpapering effect with the Paisley put on it.
Could be. The BMW stand was also huge, even though they no longer have the purpose-built building that Audi now has. It looked like an Apple superstore. I mean, it looked like it could have been an Apple store.
Yeah, you tweeted that, and I've been waiting for a manufacturer to seize on that whole thing. And I thought Porsche would do it first. But when you said that BMW did it, I fully expect that's what they're going to do in their showrooms, too.
They also had a ramp, a narrow roadway going above the walkway part of their stand, and they were giving rides in the i3 around that, just circling through, going somewhere out the building, then back.
And then BMW released the price, which I thought was pretty amazing, of the i8, which is what,
$136,000.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was very funny in the headline. It talked about sustainability and $136,000. And so it was like Leonardo DiCaprio, perhaps. I mean, it's just like.
Well, but now they also have the issue of, you know, what about Tesla, which, of course, if you want the long range version of the Model S, you have to pay about $100,000 or $110,000 instead of the base price, like
$68,000 or something.
That's right. And so this is still higher than that, but of course, this is an extended range electric. I had heard when David Zenly was in Germany to look over the car and take the short drive. He said that all the BMW people are impressed with Tesla. This was on the very same day that Elon Musk was giving his Q2 earnings, and an analyst asked him what he thought of BMW's electrification, and he basically kind of laughed at it. He said, "Well, I'm glad they're finally coming to the party," and then they started chuckling together.
Yeah,
it's interesting, the juxtaposition of BMW actually having admiration for Tesla. And remember, this is BMW; they don't.
Well, I get Elon's attitude. I mean, yeah, that's part of his gig, but he should be careful
with
that, because he has no idea what he's, you know, when BMW and Mercedes and Porsche. And to a lesser degree, Audi, I guess, when they unleash their full firepower in this whole thing, I gotta say, it's Tesla might be a buzz and might be overvalued by, you know, 50 times. But when you get the firepower of the BMW showrooms with those cars, Tesla's gonna be in serious trouble.
I agree, no question.
Yeah. Now, what about the i3? Huh? Is that just kind of forgettable, or is
no? I mean, they were using that, like I said, as the shuttle cars, and they were offering the
amusement
drive
device.
You know, it's very upright. It looks very practical, very urbanish. I think there could be a kind of urban chic to it.
Yeah, kind of a funky, cool thing about it.
I'm not writing it off the way some of my colleagues in the business are.
You know, it's weird when I see the i3 and then the option is to put the power unit on.
Right.
I only look at it as leave the power unit off so it's light.
Yeah.
And just use it literally for
around town,
you know, 20 miles or less, because I like the idea of it as that pure 2,800 pound car. And then once you add the power unit, you know, it adds, what, 300 pounds to it or something?
Didn't somebody show at an auto show, it was in the last 5 years, that you basically had a trailer that you towed along with you that was full of batteries for your electric car. I mean, I'm serious. I mean, someone actually did that. It's just like, what an absurd thing. But in this case,
yeah,
it's
what's
like
the power density mathematics to this.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like this is an option, right? So this is the extra power option to have this thing. So it's like basically, okay, so let's get an electric car and we'll run around with a Honda generator. Yeah. And we'll put that on a little trailer behind us, and then when we need it, they'll...
I'm wondering, too, about the i3, whether... I just kind of caught this on the periphery that there is a lease deal that the Europeans will get on the car that won't be offered in the United States. Did you hear something about that?
Yeah, I heard something about
that. And whether that scene is more of a city car as a pure electric, if you don't get the engine option, in cities like the cities in Europe rather than...
Here.
Certainly in Los Angeles, it wouldn't work very well.
No.
And so I wonder if they're kind of writing that car off for the U.S. a little bit. I mean, they may do well with rich people who would buy it as a second car, commuter car in part areas around New York and Chicago and maybe San Francisco, but certainly not L.A. And kind of in the same way the 5 Series GT or whatever they call that thing. They've kind of written that off for the U.S., I think.
Yeah. Well, the 3 Series GT, they're not writing off because that's new that they're bringing here.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't know. It'll be interesting with the i3, who buys it, how they market it. You know, the touchy-feely enclaves. I mean, BMW is going to have the full onslaught. And, frankly, the i8 is pretty spectacular. So...
Yeah.
People willing to spend that kind of cheese, I mean, and they're really living in those parts of the country, I'm sure it's going to be very desirable and high on the list.
I'm thinking the i3 is almost a perfect London car, right?
Yeah.
I mean, with the taxes and rules there.
Yeah, you leave your Rolls Wraith in the country,
and if you're an Aston customer, you've got the Signet, which is a glorified Toyota IQ, and that thing's in the 40s, I believe, isn't it?
It's just unbelievable. That's one thing.
Would you rather have, the Signet or the i3 to drive through London?
I'd have the i3. Of course. The Signet's embarrassing.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
So what else? Okay, well, and then we have the 918 Porsche 918 Spyder, which, of course. For show news value, they announced and they showed on video, it turned a 6-minute and 57-second lap
right
at the Nürburgring Nordschleife, which is like eye-popping.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the thing is a technology tour de force. I mean, they're developing it in conjunction with their Le Mans car. And,
right.
I mean, it's just a spectacular thing, and it's, how much is it? They haven't,
Short of $1 million, I believe.
It's 867 horsepower, all in, 600 with the V8, and then the electric power. You know, I love these cars. I love that. I love the McLaren P1. I mean, but it's really become, these are true show ponies for these manufacturers. I mean, the people who buy them, I would say 0.1% actually drive them as they were meant to be driven on some sort of track day. The rest end up as, trophy purchases for garages that people, I mean, you know, you see these cars down the road. You will see them down the road with 600 miles on them in 3 years, if that. It's just, it's a weird thing. I mean, the manufacturers have to do it. They have to be in the image wrangling business. They have to put their stake in the ground. Porsche has to, they've taken a lot of hits in the last 3 years because, you know, they make all their money from Cayennes and Panameras. And their argument is it allows us to do the sports cars. And they're going back to Le Mans to remind everyone that, yes, we are still Porsche.
Right.
And so is this 918 Spyder, but I don't know.
They're trying to make the point, Peter. I think that that you can use electrification for added power. That it can be Well, it can be power instead of just economy and being a green car, and that's what they have to do. I remember I was at the Ferrari 60th anniversary a few years ago, and there they talked about how, you know, a V8 with some electrification is going to be the new V12, and you know, you've got LaFerrari's got a hybrid system, a CURS, whatever. So does the McLaren P1.
Well, Porsche has pretty much gone on record as that every future production car is going to be a hybrid.
And the number, by the way, is $845,000.
That's right.
So I looked at that number and I was thinking, gee, they could sell about a dozen of these things and cover a good bit of their engineering development costs by doing that.
You know, let's get back to the 918 in a minute. Ben, let's hear from our friends from Bridgestone. We'll take a little break.
Introducing a car company that's never made a single car. Legendary durability. Impressive mileage. Firestone tires. So unstrap the saddle. These old stallions are ready to run. Again. Whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
AutoLine offers you one of the most effective ways to get your marketing message in front of the decision makers in the global automotive industry. Contact Stacy Eamon today.
Was a message from our friends at Firestone. And a little sidebar, you noticed they were shooting in a dry desert lake bed. I remember being on a shoot for a Nissan in early 86, and we were shooting in a dry desert lake bed, and it was just incredibly hot, incredibly, as you can imagine, dusty. But, you know, because of the union rules and the catering, you still have to have a hot meal served. And I just never forgot that. It was like 112 degrees, and there was like roast beef on there, and I was just like, something's not right here. Anyway.
Well, they didn't serve soup.
No, a little gritty.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, this explosion of these supercars and the 918 Spyder, I think, Porsche is pretty much telegraphing that there will not be a non-hybrid Porsche that you can buy sooner rather than later. I think they pretty much telegraphed this is what where they're going.
And you start at the top of the range,
yeah,
where you can absorb the costs, and as you develop it and bring the costs down, we know that the cost of the Chevy Volt is lower now than it was when it launched, even if they're still not making money on it or losing money on it. But you bring the costs down and then it's a little more palatable when you get into those everyday 911s that only cost $125,000 or so.
Well, these Europeans are really, I mean, they're hard up against these emission regulations that are coming in. I mean, they've got to reduce, you know, their CO2 per kilometer and, you know, in a huge, huge way.
Yeah.
And I think to your point, Peter, about, you know, Porsche saying, well, you know, regardless of what it is, we're going to need some electrification because they're going to need to somehow offset things coming out of the tailpipe by having, you know, alternative means of energy, and you know whether it's CURS, you know, the kinetic energy reclamation system that these guys are using, which is basically fancy regenerative braking, or something else. I mean, they've got no choice because it's a tough problem, and so I think that. Well, and this may get back to why the Germans now are down with electrification, because let's face it, I mean, you know, you can have a clean diesel, but you're still getting emissions, and you got to take care of that. And then the after treatment system has become so very expensive, you might as well have.
And I also think in Porsche's case, and to their credit, it had to be a performance application, like you mentioned. I mean, they couldn't get away with, you know, doing anything else. So they had to prove that they could do it to their satisfaction first. And, yeah, the 918 Spyder is their showpiece, but it's just going to all answer down.
To the VW up.
I, you know, I, It's just a different thing. Now, I mean, the 918 looks gorgeous. I mean, I like the top exiting pipes. That's really
sick. Yeah, it looks good. I think, while I would never want to give any credit to Bernie, I think you have to give Formula One a little bit of credit for the KERS system that they mandated two or three seasons ago.
Yeah,
and that has actually enhanced the viewing racing, watching the races. I mean, the KERS can be used in only certain parts of the circuit, and it can be used to the advantage of catching the car in front. So. You know, you show that it's not just for clean air. It's got some.
Yeah, and you know, while we're on Formula One, Kimi Raikkonen is going back to Ferrari, and I envision titanic battles now.
Leave me alone! I know what I am doing.
I know what to do.
Yeah.
But I mean, I envision titanic battles next year between Ferrari, Red Bull and McLaren. I mean, it's
and with the new engine formula too,
right?
V6s,
right. Yeah,
it's turbos, right?
But it also we'll get back to other things. But it also makes me contemplate Formula E. Now, you know, I tried to get the hydrogen electric thing going in 2007, and I got some very nice pats on the head, but. You know, these manufacturers, since the economy was about to tank, weren't ready to embrace it. The idea being you race hydrogen electric vehicles to solve all the big issues, you know, because you let the racers, you know, the storage problems, mm-hmm. you know, recharging and all that stuff and the heat, you know, you were going to solve it. But one of the part of the rules package I had was each manufacturer had to have a sound signature, because I realized you cannot go to a race and have it sound like a yeah. I mean, it just, I mean, it was disconcerting enough when Audi went to the turbo diesel, mm-hmm. when you went to the track and you could actually hear the tires slipping in the corners. Mm-hmm. That was disconcerting. Mm-hmm. And when I came up with the Hydrogen Electric Racing Federation, I just said, you know, you really can't have racing with noise. You can't have racing that sounds like really angry vacuum cleaners.
Without noise, you mean.
Yeah, without noise.
Actually, you just hear the compressors, that'd be it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I keep seeing all this stuff for Formula E, and I'm gathering that, and I've read a lot about it. They're projecting it as more of the, you know, the benign type of racing, you know, that so these cities who wouldn't have, you know, agreed to have races in their limits, city limits, are now saying, oh, well, this is cool, L.A., mm-hmm. Beijing, and I'm just like, you know, there's an awful lot of noise and effort and money and everything going into Formula E, but I'm not so sure racing without noise is sellable.
The America's Cup's got problems and they don't have much noise.
Yeah. Yeah. I used to cover America's Cup on the business side back in the day. And
God, the money.
Larry
Ellison's, oh, man.
I was at the San Diego Business Journal in the late 80s, early 90s, and that's exactly the point. That was like 1989 was like 1968 for Formula One, where suddenly you went from these little, you know, no advertising, you know, blue blood teams to advertising all over the place, and high tech carbon fiber masts and computers mm-hmm. on board and all that.
And now the sales are complete carbon fiber.
Sales, actually, they were back then.
These don't even move.
Yeah.
I mean, they're
how much
solid.
Is that new? How much is that boat that Ellison's, the Oracle thing? I mean, what's the cost of that catamaran they're using? It's got to be.
I don't know.
Hundreds of millions. Seriously.
Yeah. It's Formula One money, isn't it?
And he's losing. Yeah. So.
Oh, is he?
Yeah. New Zealand is taking him to the cleaners. So.
So, what other hits from Frankfurt can you tell us about?
Let's see the other hits. I rather like the Opel Monza. Although you look at it, and there's a lot of eyewash there. You've got the gullwing doors, of course. But if you look at the design itself, similar to the way it works on the Mercedes S-Class Coupe, the front end, the nose, everything, you know, from the A-pillar forward was just really nicely sculptured, nicely designed with a fairly bold grille using the traditional opal look. The side surfacing was maybe a little bit over the top, but also worked pretty well. If you could kind of imagine it maybe a little bit taller and without the glowing doors as a four-door sport coupe, something like that might work. I think it was a pretty good job. I would also... The Ford S-Max was a nice-looking car, and it's something that we won't get here, no way. Right. But they took the... current Ford design language with the Aston Martin grille that, of course, they don't call the Aston Martin grille, but gave a wedge-shaped sort of MPV behind it that looks a lot better than you'd think of being an MPV. I just thought it was a fairly tidy design. The one thing I should mention is the unanimous hatred for the Lexus concept. I mean, that was almost too easy to bash, frankly.
Yeah.
It had so much going on. You know, my tweet was, life was easier when Lexus design was boring and anodyne.
Yeah.
It's almost like they're just trying to,
trying so hard.
And it had so many sharp angles on it and extra bodywork. It almost looks like it's got... like they're trying to build running boards into it. And then it has this really kind of creased grille with a little bit of the current Lexus shape to the grille, but just way over the top.
Well, the photos made it look over the top. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just like you just looked at them in silence with yourself, just like,
yeah.
OMG.
It looks just the same in person, unfortunately.
There it is.
Yeah, that's it.
It's just got an awful lot going on there.
Yeah, you can just stop at awful. it's
wow.
Something else. LF, and so this is the this is previewing.
So what is it about the size of Escape?
Yeah, I guess so. Although it's almost hard to tell with all those creases and angles, but it's supposed to be their C or CD sized. Crossover, some smaller than an RX, so I guess that would be a C. Look at that grill. Amazing stuff. And
how did the Jaguar crossover look?
Jaguar. Yeah, we need to talk about the Jaguar crossover. Yeah. I think it looked exactly as you would expect. I thought it looked fine. I'm not a big fan of everybody doing crossovers.
Yeah, I'm not either. But
I'm in fact a big fan of not doing them if you don't need to. And they've got Land Rover, of course, but this clearly has this is clearly distinctly a Jaguar and not a Land Rover. So it's been designed not to step on Land Rover's toes. It, you know, looks like it could compete with a Porsche Cayenne. Ian Callum in an interview. A roundtable interview described it as being kind of between the Audi Q5 and Audi Q7 in size, so he'd call it Q6 if there was a Q6, and which sounds about right.
Well,
I wanted more of an all-road kind of look.
Yeah, it was interesting because I mentioned it on the website, but they played the it's every inch a Jaguar card, and I was just like, oh, they didn't just play that. Yes, they did.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But, you know, whatever.
Now, at the same time, they confirmed what we all have known for a while, that Jaguar will do a BMW 3 Series competitor. It'll be on this new all-aluminum platform, which they say is very flexible. Which this is on as well. So this might give a little bit of a hint. If you can imagine this going back to a sports sedan, if you think of how some sedans have spawned crossovers, you know, that are kind of based on them, you might get a little idea for the design direction. This thing has tail lamps that are not like the other Jaguar sedans, but are like the new F-Type. So, Ian about it, he said that's going to be the...
Yeah, they said in the release that the back end's just like the F-Type.
When I was looking at the side view of that vehicle, it reminded me a whole lot of the Mazda CX-5. And if we you know, play conspiracy theory here and we think about who Ian's brother is, Moray, and what Moray's job was before he was head of design at Ford, and he was at Mazda.
And there it is, this side profile.
Yeah, and I mean, that just sort of really reminded me of that. Now, the front end is a little not tucked in as much as
the short overhangs.
Yeah, very nice.
I do think that's very nice.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sure that the car will come with those 22s, right?
That was my least favorite part of it there. I think Cadillac might be onto something. They have 20s available on the new XTS V Sport, but the more serious sport sedan, the CTS V Sport, comes with 18s and 19s, and I'd like to see that trend kind of continue. I ran into a few other designers there. Murray Callum was also there, and I was there on the Ford trip, so I had some time with him. I ran into Peter Horbury over at the Volvo stand. I need to talk about the Volvo, I think. And Simon Cox was talking to him, and Simon Cox just went to Infinity Design.
Right. So. I thought that Volvo Coupe was handsome.
Very handsome. Very handsome. Very nicely done. They did a beautiful job of displaying it because they had it on the floor and it was spinning slowly. And then they had
the 1800 in the back
above. So you could stand back and wait for it to turn in the right direction and take the picture of the two together. And
I thought it looked handsome in the pictures. I would have liked to have seen this up in person.
Very, very important thing about this car is that it has a rear-wheel drive dash-to-axle ratio. They talked about having a elegant or prestige proportions on the car. And this will be on the same platform as the XC90 replacement, and, you know, being Volvo, pretty much everything in different sizes, just like BMW cutting different sizes, will handle the entire...
I especially like the back end.
The back end's very nice, yeah. And it's got some cues of the P1800 without being without being retro. But so Volvo obviously is looking at what Audi has done with longitudinal
profiles, great
engines and front wheel drive. Now, one thing that Robert Cumberford pointed out to me is those little creases above the wheel opening lip there.
Right.
He said he liked that until he was riding into the. Because he saw it in Sweden a couple of weeks ago, and then he was on the road someplace, being driven someplace, and he noticed that the VW Crafter van sold in Europe has the same thing.
Well,
so he dinged it for that, but I think this was almost universally a hit among both my colleagues and people from other magazines.
So what's the likelihood that that'll become a real car?
Well, I guess if Geely really, if they continue to fund it, why not? I mean, they could use a halo. It's a very handsome car. If you can do that platform in different sizes, different wheelbases, and pretty much create a whole new lineup of Volvos, they're promising a bunch of product in the next few years.
But there was that big dust up that Geely wants a large.
Well, there's a massive internal philosophical struggle because the Chinese owners want to go way up
scale, yeah,
in their market, and the other people that they bring on and broom out on a regular basis are saying, you guys.
Right.
Getting way ahead of yourself.
Yeah, so if the owners want big, stylish may not come anytime soon.
But if that's a sign of the design direction, at least that's a good sign.
Well, maybe they'll do that, and then they'll do one with an 18-inch stretch for China.
Horbury told me, by the way, that he's not doing anything on Volvo anymore. He's strictly Geely. I wasn't aware of that.
Read that he'd made that move.
And when they made him chief of all Geely design, it wasn't clear, at least to me, whether that meant also Volvo being part of Geely or not. But they're going to have their own design studios. He's working out of Shanghai. They just built a new studio, and he said, you know, they've got a car on the market now that was shown as a concept a year ago at the, I guess that was Beijing last year. So he said he's amazed at how quickly they're able to move. Now, I haven't seen the car. I'm not sure which car it is. And being Chinese, who knows whether it's something anybody would want to own outside of China. But, you know, it's interesting how they're structuring that.
Well, it's also interesting that Simon Cox is now doing
at Infiniti.
Infiniti, but yeah. He's staying in England.
Yes.
Yeah,
they're opening a London studio.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting.
Rather than Hong Kong, but
well, Johan's pulling out all the stops. Johan Dennison to try to turn Infiniti into something more.
So to make it much more separate from Nissan specifically.
Yeah. So they had the introduction of the what Q.
Oh, the Q30. That's the other thing. Also, a pretty good looking car. Now this has.
This, crossover.
This is a. It's really more of a. It's almost an Audi A3 competitor. Oh. I don't think they even try to pass it off as a crossover. It's basically a four-door hatchback, entry premium car. It'll be built in England, so even if they're talking about bringing it here, I don't know whether. I'm not clear on whether they have plans to do a sedan version. They probably do because they could do it for China as well.
Who did that car? Do
we? It's got the Nakamura kink, as you see.
Yeah.
I don't know. It certainly wasn't Cox because he's only been there a couple of weeks. But yeah. I'm not sure who did.
Did you get a sense of how they're being received in Germany as a company? I mean,
yeah, you know, it's funny. They've been working really hard, probably since 2008 or 2009, when they first started showing cars at Geneva and trying to expand what they're doing in Europe. You don't see a lot of them on the road. I don't think they're being embraced there yet. I think Germany seems to only like foreign cars when they're on the lower end, when they're, you know, priced below their own Volkswagens, basically. I mean, Hyundais do incredibly well in Germany, mm-hmm. and Kias, for that matter. So I think just like anybody else, just like Cadillac, if it ever tries a serious attempt to make it in Europe, it's going to be a long, hard fight. It's going to be decades. But it looks like they're in for the long haul. You know, when you've got the Chinese market to help prop up your business case to expand outside of the U.S., which is what Infiniti is, it makes it easy to lose money but try to gain a foothold in Western Europe, where they've got all these traditional classic luxury brands.
Yeah. Let's take a little break here. Ben, let's hear from our friends at Hyundai.
What's my type? Well, they have to be smart, a good sense of direction, good taste in music, and, of course, good looks with nice curves. That gets my temperature rising every time we touch. And that exotic name, Elantra. Wait, are we talking about cars?
Okay. Another news item this week that sort of popped up today was GM introducing their SUVs. Gary, what do you make of that? In the middle of the Frankfurt show, they just happened to have an announcement of their new SUVs.
Well, you know, if you think about it, the pickup trucks upon which the SUVs are being based, the Tahoe and the Suburban and the Yukon... And
the Yukon XL.
Yeah,
XL.
Right.
And Denali versions.
Yeah. Right. And I mean, if you think about it, so the reception to the pickups has been, design-wise at least,
tepid.
Lukewarm at the hottest.
Yes.
And so especially the front ends of
There's the Tahoe.
You know, that they're, I think that that perhaps should have been the front end that they put on those pickup trucks. Yeah. And so I think what they're trying to do is like, you know, whoa, wait a minute, guys, you know, we still got something here. And so I think that would be the reason for them to make the announcement. Now, you know, it seemed rather unusual. They made the announcement for the Chevys in New York City and for the GMC in Los Angeles. And, you know, when I think sport utilities, I think New York and L.A. I mean, that's...
Well, I do, too, as long as it's a Range Rover.
Yeah.
Of course, there are, you know, unconfirmed, wildly irresponsible rumors that GM is rushing a, or considering rushing a redesign of the front end of the...
And, you know, that's the only place you can do any kind of facelift. I mean, it's, as you see from, well, although these are body on frame, so you can do more. But, you know, you look at what was quickly rushed to the Chevrolet Malibu and to the Honda Civics.
Yeah.
From my point of view, thinking of trucks as only a tool is not, not the type of thing I aspire to own.
Yeah.
Personally, you know, I don't know that... It's that big of a deal that the Chevy Silverado and the GMC Sierra outside don't look that different from inside.
The
good thing is that the interiors are much nicer.
Yeah, actually, I think the Sierra looks pretty good.
Right.
I think the Silverado was a bit of a letdown, and you know, they have the Ram, whatever, the Ram, the Dodge Ram to deal with, and
the Ram,
and you know, and
who knows what they're gonna do with the F-150.
Well,
so I mean, if that comes out,
Ford tipped their hand with the Atlas at Detroit, which I thought was premature, but then again, they've gone dark on it since. So you know, I suspect that the F-150 is gonna be
Well, they're concentrating on Mustang. Don't forget, Ford has two huge launches for the U.S.
Huge
in the coming year.
You know, the F-150 is the franchise for Ford, and the Mustang is the soul of the company. So this, you can't get...
Yeah.
This is probably the biggest year for a car company I can remember. I mean, of course, GM had the Corvette this past year, but to have two iconic vehicles to launch, that's big time stuff.
That's huge. That's huge. One other thing I should mention about Ford at Frankfurt is that they also showed this new Vignale, which will go into production in 2015. It's basically Ford of Europe's Lincoln.
Black Label.
It's Lincoln, because they don't have Lincoln there, and it's a the Ford Mondeo sedan or wagon with a new grille, which, again, is something you can do without any...
Well, it's a nice name.
Very nice stitched leather interior.
Nice name.
And they're going to have concierge service and all sort of thing. So they're kind of doing the Hyundai thing, as Mercedes and BMW and Audi are introducing entry-level luxury cars. So they're kind of meeting at that. In the U.S., it would be about $30,000. I think it would be you know, probably 35 or 40,000 euro in Europe, but that's an interesting thing. I just, you know, Jay Mays talks about having a premium look and luxury to the mainstream buyer with what Ford does in cars like the Fusion Mondeo, and you know, I just think, you know, this is the company that Henry built to put the world on wheels with the Model T. It's nicely done, but I just wonder, you know, this would be above a titanium trim level, which they sell in Europe as well as the U.S.
So it almost strikes me as being more like a Mercury than like a Lincoln.
Well, it depends on where you consider Lincoln's position right now. I'd say Lincoln is kind of where Mercury should have been if they really wanted to do anything with Mercury. Yeah, I guess it is, because they're just popping in a different grill. You're right.
Right.
And nicer trim. But really, this car, you have to keep in mind, though, too, that the Mondeo is not the big mainstream car in Europe that it is here. There, the Focus is by far the biggest seller. And And the Mondeo actually has been sold for many years as kind of an entry level, a competitor to a low spec BMW 3 Series, even though Mondeo's front wheel drive and 3 Series is rear wheel drive, the so called executive car. So the junior exec who isn't quite ready to spend the money for a BMW yet, they'll sell him a Mondeo, and they've done fairly well with that.
Yeah. What else is going on? You just got back from a drive that you can't talk about.
Right. Although it was sort of interesting. So I think what I can talk about, though, is that I had the opportunity to drive the Ram 1500 with the Echo diesel engine in it.
No.
So I can't talk about that so much. But it was to this point, we're talking about the Silverado and the F-150 and the Ram being a competitor. And, you know, it's interesting that, you know, and this is announced and everybody knows this, that you know, the diesel is going into the Ram. And, you know, and I was talking to some of the executives and the engineers related to that program, and they think that this will be a sufficient differentiator to get people who might buy a Chevy or who might buy a Ford to come over and look at what they're doing because of that engine, because they're the only ones that are going to be offering it in a light-duty truck right now.
What about Nissan?
That's coming later.
Yeah.
So that's going to be, 2015, I think, before they're going to have that.
Mm-hmm.
So
and it's Nissan. They just don't sell many big trucks at all.
And it's a Cummins diesel, and Chrysler has Cummins diesels, if you want, in their heavy-duty lineup. And
so they think that's the differentiator.
That is a differentiator that will, let's face it. It seems to me that in all of cardom, there are basically two groups of people that are really obsessed by their vehicles. One are the truck owners, and one are the muscle car owners, right? I mean, so nobody really is all excited about their Malibu and their Fusion and their Altima or Camry, whatever, right? I mean, it's just, they may like their cars, but the truck guys, I mean, are really, you know, it's hard to budge somebody from a Ford to a Chevy.
Right.
So you got to do
almost impossible.
Right.
Especially
and if you think about it, you know, when Ram came out with the new design back in, what was it, like 94 now, I think,
Yeah, 90. You mean when they first did the bold Ram truck?
Right.
Was that a 93 model, maybe? I'm not sure.
Yeah, but I mean, it's been a long time now.
Yeah.
But you think about it, I mean, you know, and that was when Lutz was there, and he basically, you know, made the statement. It was like, you know, let's go big or go home, because we've got such a small portion of this market. We got to do something, okay? And they did it. And they were successful at it. I mean, they grew a lot of market share. So in effect, I mean, this isn't as striking as that, you know, complete redesign was, but it gives them something in the market that these other guys can't touch. And so I think that, you know, to try to get the appeal of that, you know, all important market segment, because I mean, that's, you know, pickup trucks are key for all the domestic makers. I mean, it's just,
there's something interesting happening with pickup trucks. I think Ford, and I only caught a little bit of the sales call for the August sales. They're now talking about how the ATPs on pickups are inching up well into the 30s, and they're talking about the old, what I call the suburban cowboy customer coming back again. And it just makes me think of how when we went through that awful period in 07, 08, 09, pundits talked about the domestic industry relying on trucks too much. And they were kind of like, well, we're going to get away from trucks. We're going to make money on small cars for the first time. And now they're doing really well with trucks. I just hope they don't take their eyes off of the...
Well, that's an interesting point. I mean, obviously, Ford's small car lineup is completely enhanced, revamped, revised, really going on. But at the same time, they just announced that they're increasing the production of the Raptor from 3 a day to 5 a day, and they just can't build enough of them. And I mean, the Raptor is an awesome truck.
Sure.
I mean, I don't have any use for it, but I appreciate it. But it's just, it's the dichotomy in this business. But let's face it, I mean, these car companies, at least the ones based in the U.S., I mean, the money is pickup trucks.
Well, and there's a new reason for trying to get back in pickup truck market, and that's CAFE. All these higher standards we've got for 2016 and 2025. Well, guess what? There's the footprint deal, and then there's the trucks get a big break relative to small cars. Small cars have to get the same kind of increase, which is harder once you're already in the upper 30s or low 40s than it is for a pickup truck. And which is why Volkswagen is one of the few manufacturers that has not been in favor of the 2026 CAFE, so, or 2025 CAFE, sorry. Mm-hmm. So,
well, since Gary, you touched upon muscle vehicles briefly, my column this week was entitled "Reimagining the Candy-Colored Tangerine Flake Streamline Baby." Probably a lot of people out there weren't aware of Tom Wolfe's short stories from 1965, but that descriptor remains indelible of a certain period and sort of labeled our car culture wonderfully, and I haven't found anything better. And I talked about how, you know, we are on the verge of a completely different thing now. And I think cars like the i8, it's just a different ballgame, the 918 Spyder, but more so the i8, because it's just such a, you know, and someone say, well, Tesla, no, this is different. I mean, the i8 is a super sports car from a major German manufacturer, and it's just changed. It signals a sea change. I mean, our cars are more complicated. If you really want performance, which will still be there, it's going to be costly, more complicated. Our cars are connected to the hilt, which I don't think is a great thing.
No.
But, you know, this business has changed. But as I said, somehow the soy-based chlorophyll-specced self-driving module doesn't have the same ring to it as Tom Wolfe's wonderful prose. But, you know, we're on the verge of something. I hope it's mostly good.
See, now what could happen, I mean, if we go back to Wolfe's book and, you know, the whole hot rod culture, Ed Roth and guys like that that were doing things in the 60s to cars and modifying them in exotic ways, just think about this possibility whereby you have a whole cadre of young people who have grown up with an incredible intelligence related to things all electronic and computer, who begin to take their module cars and begin to hack into them, yeah, you know, in ways to make them do all kinds of wonderful things, and to be able to start taking the sheet metal doors off and installing carbon fiber door panels and things like that. So there is this possibility.
Oh, yeah.
You could actually get to that sort of culture that once existed.
I hope so. I remember in the 70s when there was a 165 horsepower Z28. I thought we were at the end of the world, and I was all doom and gloom until for a couple years until I realized that, oh, wait a minute, you know, and then things got better and better and better, and now here we are with 1,000 horsepower cars and 600 horsepower cars like everywhere,
and also to the point, 2 to 250 horsepower four-cylinder cars.
Yeah, tremendous cars. The Focus ST, the GTI. I mean, yeah, we have. So we're on the verge of something, and hopefully it'll stay.
It can go either.
Yeah, hopefully the car culture will stay great.
Let's hope we're able to drive them ourselves and not have them drive.
Well, you know, the whole autonomous vehicle thing, I mean, I know John's a big believer on it for some urban centers, and I think, frankly, maybe that's a good use for him. But, you know, I probably won't be one of those people who... I hope they keep a lane for people who still want to actually steer and brake and look out and at what they're doing.
You know, it's
driving lane.
It's going to be like, I think it'll start out on the freeways. It'll be like
the
transponder for the toll roads where first they had four rows where you'd toss in the change and the one row where you'd have your little transponder. Now it's the other way around, and if you don't have the transponder, you're like, I hope I don't get in the wrong lane. I think that's what it's going to be, and it's going to happen fairly quickly. You had Nissan talking about, at its 360 event, talking about having full autonomy by 2020. How do you define full autonomy is the one question. I heard a lot of consternation in Frankfurt from some ranks of Nissan's announcement of that it was just a PR grab, and you know, everybody thinks they're ahead of the others regarding autonomous cars.
Didn't Mercedes also announce that they're going to have?
Mercedes did a demonstration with an S-Class. The way you'll be able to buy it, beginning late this year or early next year, is with some light autonomy, which you can also get in the Acura RLX and in the Infiniti Q50. But they did some demonstration where they had the car drive itself over bridges and a fairly...
Like, damn you, I'll be autonomous too.
The technology is really there. It's really all they're talking about now is how do we get through the legal issues?
Well, I had a 911 Carrera 4S, and it had the radar cruise control on it, and that was so disconcerting and such a disconnect in a 911 that I was just freaked out by it. It was just like, whoa, this is so not 9/11. Mm-hmm. What's going on right here, right now? But oh well, that we'll be talking about autonomous cars for a long, long time to come.
Yep.
Well, we've reached the end of the road, folks. Time to put the campfire out and mosey out and see what's going on. And I'd really like to thank our guest today, Todd Lasa, for making it here almost literally from the airport. Really appreciate it, Todd.
Thanks, Peter. Good to be here.
And Gary, always a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you, Peter.
And you can see our stuff at the various places, autoextremist.com, Twitter. I'm Peter M. DiLorenzo because I had a hacker. You can go to autoextremist Facebook page if you want. You can visit a friend Autoline at facebook.com/AutolineNetwork. And you can follow Autoline on Twitter at twitter.com/Autoline. And Todd, we can read your stuff at?
At automobilemag.com, where I blog as the Motor City Blogman, also in the magazine Automobile. And you can follow me on Twitter, am_Lasa.
And Gary, you're at Automotive Design and Production, but you're at
AutoFieldGuide.com.
AutoFieldGuide.com. And thanks again for joining us, everyone. It's been a pleasure, and we'll see you all next week.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by the 2013 Hyundai Elantra. Learn more at Hyundai.com.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There is all that and much more at autoline.tv.